whereas philosophy is certainly not self-expression. And philosophy, of course, is argument. And you can say, well, is the conclusion true or is the argument valid?
Welcome to Season 3 of Five Questions, the podcast where we don't ask if the conclusion's true or the argument valid, but what they say about you. I'm your host, Kiran Setia. In each episode, I ask a philosopher five questions about themselves. There are two ground rules. One is that follow-up questions are allowed. The other is that the question I'm about to ask doesn't count as one of the five. So could you introduce yourself, tell us a bit about who you are and what kind of philosophical work you do?
Hi, I'm Jeppa Polikathile. I am a philosophy professor at the University of Pittsburgh. Before Pitt, I was at NYU for a few years, and I work on moral and political philosophy. And I especially think about questions at the intersection of moral and political philosophy. So I think a lot about the ways in which moral norms shape the answers to the foundational questions of political philosophy. So why should there be a state and what kind of state should there be? And I've also thought a bit about Kant's political philosophy. So as far as historical figures go, I've spent a lot of time thinking about Kant.
So the inspiration for the podcast is Iris Murdoch. And before I turn to some of the Iris Murdoch questions inspired by her work, I wanted to ask you if you have a view about Murdoch. I'm not sure she's someone whose work has been significant for you, but she often caricatures Kant and Kantian moral philosophy in a way that's sort of designed to provoke the Kantians among us. So is that something that you've sort of, you have a reaction to?
You know, I think I confess that I became acquainted with Murdoch in any depth actually only after arriving at Pitt. So I think like the Murdoch style sort of challenges to Kant, I wasn't familiar with them in my formative years. So maybe I've dug in my heels too deeply to be terribly moved by those kinds of criticisms. But I do feel like the Murdoch material that I'm familiar with does bring out a way in which some of the Kantian views on the nature of action might be overly simplistic, or there are ways in which maybe there are parts that Kant himself doesn't focus on, but that we could charitably fill in for his view about the ways in which our experiences and the ways in which sort of what we're bringing to the action is already very rich before we get to the part where we test maxims and stuff like that. But I should also say, I think that, you know, my occupation with Kant is more in the political philosophy than in the moral philosophy. And I think that there's a lot there that's actually, there's more resonance than one might have expected, at least in my particular reading of Kant, because I'm someone who thinks that the Kantian project is one where we have these sort of general constraints on the nature of the state, but a lot has to be filled in by actual activity of citizens working it out together. So I think that we sort of approach something like our moral views through working together in articulating them. I think that that's something that's sort of at home in the Murdoch style view, as far as in the limited way that I'm familiar with it.
That's really interesting. Yeah, no, I think that's right. And I think it's also true that one of the things it's hard to tell from her, the writings in which she is derisive of Kant, is what exactly her view about political philosophy is. And so that's an area where it would be interesting to try to explore connections. But I'm going to resist doing that, since this podcast is not about Kantian political philosophy, at least not directly. And I'm going to ask you the Murdoch question I always start with. So she begins the podcast telling us that philosophy is not self-expression, but she also wrote, "To do philosophy is to explore one's temperament, and yet at the same time to attempt to discover the truth." So does your temperament influence your philosophy? And if so, how?
You know, it's such a super hard question, because I think it's really hard to have a really accurate sense of one's temperament from the inside. So I'm not confident about how my temperament shapes my philosophy, though I'm sure it does in some important ways. I was thinking that maybe one way in which my temperament might shape some of the topics that have been interesting to me or have gripped me over the years, so they're all kind of united by this focus on coercion and pressure and the ways in which we can sort of make people do things. And I wonder if that might be an interest. I mean, that's an interest I've had basically as long as I've had philosophical interests. So maybe starting as early as high school, I've been interested in those sorts of questions. And I think my interest in the state and in the ways in which it particularly uses coercion might have been shaped in some way by being the child of Indian immigrants. So my parents were Indian immigrants, and I was born in the United States, but I grew up in this way where we had a kind of sort of immigrant patriotism about the United States, where the United States was really, really great, and our political leaders were really great, and the state was really great. But that was also sort of combined with a sort of feeling of otherness. I grew up in the Midwest, and you know, the late 80s, early 90s, there weren't a whole lot of Indian people around. It was a pretty white suburb. So I feel like the combination of having been raised in this kind of, like, as I say, kind of patriotic way, but combined with a kind of feeling of otherness, I feel like that's part of why the questions about the state and the state's use of power maybe have always gripped me.
That's really interesting. I mean, it would be interesting to talk more about your early interest in philosophy. I think I remember that when you were in high school, you read Kant's Metaphysics of Morals, not the groundwork, but the big, long, involved masterpiece of Kant's late moral philosophy. Is that true? Is that how you got interested in philosophy?
Yeah, well, that was one of the texts that was inspiring. But that is, yeah. So really what happened was I was a high school debater, and I did a style of debate called Lincoln-Douglas debate. And so that's a debate about value propositions. And mostly what you did in debate was, like, you just pulled quotes, and there were like books of quotations that you were using to try to build arguments. But I wanted to, like, understand better the views that I was quoting. So I just went to Barnes & Noble, and I basically just bought a large chunk of the political philosophy shelf. Ah. So I read Hobbes, I read Locke, I read Rousseau. And then I read, there was a political philosophy volume of Kant's from back in the day. I think it was called Political Writings. And in there was a large chunk of the Metaphysics of Morals. So that was my first acquaintance with Kant. And that was the view that gripped me even then. So even at the very beginning, in my sort of, like, broken understanding of what was going on in that text in high school, that was the one of the social contract edition that really grabbed my attention.
I mean, how did your parents react to your interest in philosophy? Were they supportive of the kind of questioning of the authority of the state, or questions about the foundations of politics, given their sort of immigrant acceptance of the United States, their patriotism?
Yeah, no, I think they definitely were very supportive. So I was very fortunate in that respect. They both had sort of philosophical backgrounds of a sort. So their story is itself, it's its own wonderful story, which could be the subject of its own podcast. But my dad was a Catholic priest and my mom was a Catholic nun. And they met and left the church and got married. And that was also a like fascinating part of my history growing up, as my dad continued to be a minister in the Presbyterian Church instead. So, but these stories about their upbringing were very, very vivid in my memory. And so they both had these sort of, like, deep philosophical backgrounds as a result of the education they received when they were becoming a priest and a nun. But then also they had that experience of questioning authority where they made this really huge choice to leave the church. And so I think that was the environment that I was raised in, where there was a lot of respect for asking big, deep, important questions. But also there was a lot of openness to challenging and thinking for yourself.
So you've had a kind of long relationship with philosophy then since high school. And in some sense, you fell in love with it early. But I want to ask a kind of question about your ongoing relationship with the discipline and the field. So this is question two. What do you love or hate most of all about philosophy?
Well, what I love about philosophy is, I think something common to most philosophers is, I love the kind of aha moment where the argument finally works itself out, where you kind of see how the steps are going to get you to where you want to be. So I really love that. And I think that's what keeps me coming back, is that I really enjoy sort of working out the puzzles and trying to get sort of deeper and closer to the truth. But what I hate about philosophy is something that I've come to realize only recently. And this is an insight that I think my husband, who's also a philosopher, James Shaw, first brought to my attention. And when he mentioned it, I just didn't take it seriously. But he was lamenting a few years ago that he had too many projects to finish and that he wasn't going to get through it all in his lifetime. And, you know, he's in his 30s. So I found this, like, laughable when he first mentioned this. But then it happened to me. In the last year or so, I realized I have too many projects that I'm never going to finish them, especially at the pace that I work at, which is rather slow. I'm not going to get through all these projects in my lifetime. And so I feel like the thing that has now really gripped me about philosophy is how big it is. And even the small part of philosophy that I work on, to make progress, it's so slow. And to do it all in a lifetime is, like, I'm not going to get there. So I feel like that's a real, it's a real sadness to me. I don't know if I'd say I hate it, but I, that is a thing about philosophy that makes me very sad.
That's really interesting. I mean, there is, I definitely share that sense that our ignorance is so vast and the difficulty of philosophy is so great and the range of questions is so intimidating that it's sort of endless and frustratingly so in a way. I have to say it's interesting to that you and James both have that sense of too many projects. I would say one of my biggest anxieties as a philosopher is every time I finish working on anything, I think, well, that's that. No more ideas. I'm done. Like I always feel like I'm about to, I don't have enough projects and I'm going to kind of run out. So it's interesting. So when you say that you sort of have this sort of surfeit of projects, do you mean like specific ideas or is it more just questions that grip you?
It's a little bit of both, but I think increasingly it's like specific projects. And I guess part of my problem is that I keep discovering that the things I want to argue for have presuppositions that I need to argue for. And then, you know, that's just an endless rabbit hole. So I keep getting stuck trying to talk about the things I really want to talk about, but then having to move a step higher in the argument to talk about the things that I need to get on the table, as it were, in order to get my arguments to go. So I think like the actual projects are now a little daunting. I think right after, you know, in the lead up to tenure, there's just all this rush just to get stuff done. And then there was this sort of brief pause for me where I was like, you know, just take a deep breath. You know, what am I going to think about now? So maybe there was a little pause there where I wasn't sure exactly where I would go next. But now for the last couple of years, I've sort of been like on a train trying to get to some conclusion that now just recedes further and further into the distance as I see the argumentative gulf open up. And I'm worried I won't make it to the finish line. I won't get to the end. But I mean, there's also, you know, there's just so much joy in the steps that get there. So that's its own enjoyable thing. You know, the aha moments along the way are still really great.
Well, having talked about what you hate most about philosophy, it's natural to ask question three. If you weren't a philosopher, what would you do instead?
So my long-term plan when I was in high school reading all those philosophy books was actually not to be a philosopher, but to be a politician of all things. I wanted to actually do it. I wanted to be involved in the government and to make changes. You know, it was idealistic. And I went through all the steps. Like, you know, I interned at my congressperson's office, at the mayor's office. I was doing lots of actual political work. I did campaigning. You know, I was really involved in actual political life. And I went to Georgetown as an undergraduate with the plan of eventually going to law school and pursuing a political career. And when I was in high school, my very supportive parents actually had business cards printed for me. It said Polkathile for president in 2016, which would have been the first year I could have run. So that was the grand ambition. So maybe I would have been president instead. I could have spared us all 2016. But yeah, so that was the plan. It was to be in political life.
And how did things swerve from there? What was the transition to deciding you were going to do philosophy and go to grad school?
As an undergraduate, I was a double major. So I was a major in government and philosophy. And I loved philosophy, but, you know, I was focused on these more practical questions. And then two things I think were happening at the same time. So I was interning for my congressperson. I was very involved in political life. And I was sort of starting to become disillusioned, as one might, with the actual political processes. They're very frustrating and slow and subject to all of these, you know, extraneous influences. So that process is hard. And at the same time, I was sort of wondering, like, you know, I want to make the world a better place, but I don't even know what it should look like. Like, what would be a better form of government, or what would be the right set of policies in this circumstance? And I was sort of starting to become more gripped with the philosophical questions. And as I was doing that, I was taking all these great philosophy classes and thinking, this is actually really what I want to do. I just want to think about these questions. And then maybe someday I'll get to actually making the changes in the world that I want to see. And, you know, that's yet another project that it looks like will not be accomplished in my lifetime, is making the more direct applications of my work to the real world. Though I still hope, I hold out hope actually for that someday I may be able to wind back around and see some of the practical upshots of my more abstract thinking.
That would be amazing. I mean, do you have regrets about the direction you took, or do you feel like this was, in retrospect, it was the right way to go?
Well, speaking of temperament, it definitely was the right way to go for me in some sense. I think I was maybe slightly self-deceived about my capacity to participate as a kind of political figure in the American political system. I think I just didn't see, young and naive that I was, what that actually involves in terms of personality and lifestyle. I think this is definitely what I'm supposed to do. Think about the questions. So in that way, I don't have regrets, but I feel some sadness at the gulf between my work right now and the more practical questions that I was interested in back then. So I would like to see, some of my work has more practical upshots. I think about sometimes more specific concrete questions in political philosophy, but I would like to see in the future, see myself move back in the direction that has more concrete implications and more straightforward application to the actual world.
Okay, I'm going to ask a question now that's even more aspirational and speculative, which is question four. If you could go back in time and meet a past philosopher, who would it be and why?
I think I would go very shortly back in time and meet Rawls. It was a great sadness to me that I just missed him when I started graduate school at Harvard. So he passed away in my second year, I think, but he was already very ill, so he was no longer in circulation when I arrived there. And he is a figure that was just so foundational. I mean, his importance for contemporary political philosophy just certainly couldn't be underestimated. But also, all the people that I respect and admire were like deeply shaped by Rawls. And so I feel like I really missed out in never encountering him in person. So I think I would go back and have that opportunity to meet him.
Well, he has, I think, come up at least twice, maybe more times, as one of the, in response to the question, who is your most inspiring teacher? What would you ask him? Are there particular questions that you have that are not really answered by his work that you'd really want to put to him?
Oh, there's so many questions about his work. I mean, I think like I am a fan of early Rawls, the Rawls of a Theory of Justice, and I'm one of those people who thinks that political liberalism was kind of a confusing turn, to say the least. So I'd like to know what was up with political liberalism. And I think I could ask so many questions about what he was up to in that text. And really, like, what were the questions that was gripping him more than like how the view works or the mechanics of the view? So at the end of A Theory of Justice, he's really trying to work out questions having to do with the stability of a just society. And those are the questions that he thinks are unsatisfactorily answered by A Theory of Justice. That's what he sort of self-reports as motivating the changes in political liberalism. But that very concern, I think, is like slightly mysterious to me. At least my orientation in Kantian political philosophy makes that concern like very slightly mysterious as he's pursuing it. He's also really concerned at the end of A Theory of Justice with what he calls the congruence between the right and the good. That's another super interesting topic that I'd love to talk more with him about or understand better his thoughts on that.
Well, this may go too deep into the weeds, but I want to ask a bit more about about the stability issue. So could you say a bit more about why that is sort of mysterious or puzzling from your perspective?
Well, I think I'm very moved by this thought of G.A. Cohen's. Something he says is like, you know, isn't it conceivable that we could have a just society, but it could be fragile? It could just be that it's on the brink of falling apart, but it is just, right? I think that's like, it seems so tempting to think that that's conceptually realistic. And I think that there's a lot to be said about what kind of stability Rawls is actually interested in and why. And I think in some ways, Rawls and Cohen are kind of at cross purposes. But the basic question there is like, you know, isn't it possible that we could have a just society that actually isn't stable? And what would that mean for treating that as a criterion or a desideratum of A Theory of Justice? I think I'm really moved by the sort of Cohen style critiques there.
So the thought is that it might be a desirable thing to have both justice and stability, but that doesn't mean that stability is sort of a condition of justice itself.
Yeah, I think. So that's definitely one of the things that I'm concerned about. I should say, you know, now we are definitely deep in the weeds. I mean, the Kantian has a kind of concern that's related to stability, which is a concern with assurance. And I'd like to also think through more deeply what the relationship is between those two things. So for the Kantian, what I'm most concerned with is, you know, securing your rights, making sure all our rights are secured. And there is something that, you know, there's something in the neighborhood of stability that should be occupying the Kantian too in trying to address the assurance problem. So I'm not saying that I think stability doesn't matter at all. I just think that the particular ways in which Rawls is sort of occupied with stability and the things that he think will actually secure stability or are necessary for stability, those are things that sort of puzzle me.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I'm going to reluctantly drag us back from talking about Kantian political philosophy to the final Murdoch question. So it's always a significant question to ask about any philosopher, she wrote, what is she afraid of? So what are you afraid of?
Yeah, so I'm going to stick with what I'm afraid of philosophically. And what I'm afraid of philosophically, I think at least one of the things is kind of being a product of my own time. To what extent are my views just like reflective of the place and time that I'm living in? When we look back on like great philosophers of the past, there are always these like unfortunate dark spots, that like places that are kind of cringy, or the places that just make you scratch your head and wonder like what were they thinking when they were writing these things. And a lot of that has to do with the cultural milieu in which they were operating. And so I worry about myself. I wonder, like, looking back, even when I myself look back on my own work, you know, hopefully 10 or 20 or 30 years from now, what will I see that makes me feel like, wow, you were just, you know, you were parroting the forces that were at the time that you were writing, as opposed to being really critically distant from them. So I guess that's something I worry about.
I mean, are there particular things that focuses on, like certain kinds of assumptions you're making that seem particularly precarious or vulnerable, that you sort of cross your fingers and hope will stand the test of time?
Well, one of the concepts that I think is hardest when we look back on philosophers in the past is they're often, especially starting in the Enlightenment, they're reaching for this idea of equality, but they have what is now a terribly limited sense of equality, you know, limited to white men property holders or whatever. So that like kind of limitation of the basic concept that they're working with, that they had what now seems to me like the right idea, but couldn't just see what was right in front of their faces, that it had a much wider application than they thought. I feel like that same thing worries me. So I also start with a sort of foundational commitment to thinking that there's a deep sense in which people are equal. And I worry that I'm going to be guilty in the same way that they were of not seeing the expansiveness of that concept, that there are ways in which I'm not seeing how powerful it is or who it applies to in the right sort of ways.
Well, maybe we'll end with the expansiveness of the concept of equality and the aspiration to get that right. And I'll say thank you, Japa, for appearing on the podcast.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Japa Pillakathiyal is Associate Professor of Philosophy at the University of Pittsburgh. She's the author of Persons and Bodies, The Possibility of Choice, and other essays in moral and political philosophy. Thanks for listening to 5 Questions.